Brianna Bass is a licensed professional counselor associate, a board certified clinical sexologist, and a founder of the Wellness Institute in Dallas, Texas, where she joins us today. With a Bachelor of Science in Psychology, a Master's in Clinical and Mental Health Counseling, and a PhD in Progress with a specialization in relationships, Brianna brings a modern, evidence-based approach to therapy that transforms life. What I thought was really interesting and sets Brianna apart is her unique dual experience. So Hacalab Corporate, where she rose to a very senior executive level, combined with years working in inpatient addiction centers. I think this distinctive background gives an unparalleled understanding of the pressures facing ambitious, high-achieving individuals navigating the challenges of modern life. We'll get straight into it then. There's a lot there, and there's a lot that I want to ask you. But I just wanted to start off by taking you back a little bit and just to understand what you were like in your formative years as a teenager. Do you think the 14-year-old Brianna would recognize who you are today?
I absolutely think the Brianna that was 14 would recognize the Brianna today, no doubt. And, you know, before we started the show, you said, you know, if I ask you anything that makes you feel uncomfortable, you know, let me know. And I was like, not really possible at this point. I've told it all. So, no exception. I was every mother's worst nightmare at 14, at 15, at 16, wise beyond my years, very mature, you know, felt like an old soul back then. I think I felt 80 for, you know, the last 30 years. So, not good for me to have any kind of idle hands, that's for sure. But I was very curious. I was sensitive, empathetic, you know, loving animals and people. So I was always very curious. So, you know, I wasn't into Barbies or dolls. That kind of thing just didn't get me going. It was taking things apart and putting them back together, reading books and science and stuff like that. So absolutely, I think she would see me today and go, yeah, this makes a ton of sense.
So were you the one that your girlfriends came to talk about periods or first kiss or first boyfriends, all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I do feel like I've always been someone that people came and confided in and you know, could tell me their things. And I think I'm known for being rather non-judgmental as well.
Which I guess is important being a therapist, working in therapy. People come and present to you with lots of different things that they're feeling incredibly challenged by, so they want someone that's going to listen. And I know you've sort of created what you call a modern approach to therapy, and I wondered how a modern approach differs from what might be seen as people's views of the more traditional lay on a couch and I'll sort of talk to you, as opposed to perhaps what you do.
Yeah, that's a great question. I do use the word modern approach and modern therapy on just pretty much anywhere I can put it. So if someone comes up with a better way to say that, please let me know. Because what I'm trying to communicate is that there's a little bit of a stereotype, stigma around therapy sometimes that, you know, how does that make you feel? Or the therapist doesn't maybe say much and the client does, you know, all of the talking and takes up all the space. And, you know, it's still immensely valuable, by the way. If you were in a situation like that, totally still worth your time and investment and energy, because that cognitive offload that you're doing in that space is still huge. If I said nothing and just showed up and, you know, still, it moves the needle. Don't get me wrong. But what I'm talking about when I say my modern therapy or modern approach is that I want, when we work together and therapy in general, to reflect the world that we actually live in today. We live in a high stimulation, high ambition, a performative world. We have chronic stress. Gender roles are a little bit confused. We're all figuring things out. We've got big movements. We've got the political climate, dating apps. Oh my gosh, dating apps. We're burned out. We're having children way older than we used to. We're comparing ourselves to everyone. Such a heavy comparison culture. So that's what I mean when I talk about modern therapy and modern approach. So I don't want to be endlessly exploratory. And I don't want to be incredibly passive, right? I want to collaborate a little bit, but definitely I want to talk about the real world that we live in. And I want people to feel comfortable saying that embarrassing thing or that humiliating thing or what otherwise would be taboo, right? Yeah. It's not missed on me that you can't go to dinner probably or brunch with a friend or a group of people and talk about those subjects that I just listed. Those are kind of not so great, right? And especially when we don't even know how to navigate them. This stuff is pretty new, really. So we're still figuring things out. We're working from home. Men are isolated. People are lonely. Our relationships now can tend to be a little bit more surface level than they used to be. We have the phone and technology in between us. It didn't used to be that way. You see how just in this short little time, I can keep going and going about all of these nuances with our world right now, how heavy it can feel and complex. So I hope that in therapy, we're talking about that stuff and what your ecosystem really looks like and how it reflects some of that modern complexity. So that's what I'm talking about when I say modern therapy, modern approach. The one other thing I'll say to that is I am science-based. So therapists can choose to take an approach of whatever their desire. You might have someone who's more, you know, maybe a Christian therapist, or they specialize in something else or what have you. My personal choice is neuroscience, the brain, and understanding why we do what we do from a biology and anatomical level, what's firing off, you know, what neurotransmitters are going, what's in the driver's seat when, you know, I don't even realize it sometimes. I think there's a lot of power in understanding that. So also when I use the word modern, I'm referencing a little bit of that too.
Wow. There's so much there. And does it feel like there are, and this is probably an unfair question. Does it feel that there are sort of themes that come through? Because I think a lot of what you said, I completely agree with. And I think one of the challenges we have now, I look back, I've got a 16-year-old son and 18-year-old daughter. And I look back at what life was like when I was 16. And just as an example, in the UK, we had 3 television channels. And pornography was a torn out page from an older brother's Playboy magazine. That was, oh my God, there's a woman that's naked. Oh my God. Well, we didn't have smartphones, we didn't have internet, didn't have on-tap pornography, didn't have access to whatever music, social media, all of those things. So do you find one of the themes, maybe answering my own question, does it feel that one of the themes coming through is just almost that it's like a fire hose of data, knowledge, information, noise coming at us, and our brains haven't necessarily caught up with how to process that. And like when I was 16, which didn't need to process it, whereas now I look at my poor son and daughter and think, in one way, wow, they're living at the most amazing time possible. You know, lifespan's much better, life quality is much better, but bloody hell, they're literally bombarded, and we somehow expect them to deal with all of that. Is that part of what you see when you deal with young professionals?
I absolutely do. That's another line that I use often, sort of to that tune, is sort of cutting through the self-help fluff, and that I'm sick of, you know, everybody being an expert. As I sit here and try to have expertise in things, I realize that. But I also will humbly admit when, you know, something goes out of my scope. But yeah, they are inundated with information and data and knowledge and opinions, and back to the whole comparative culture piece. Yeah. Oh, look at what so-and-so is doing. And, you know, they don't really see behind their curtain. They just see what they post. That can be incredibly daunting, right? So yeah, you're right. The brain being inundated like that with data and information constantly puts it in a very high stimulation state. And our brain is very, you remember this from growing up, that the word plasticity, elastic, if you remember that, you know, from like the 7th grade or whatever about the brain. It's true. So what that means is we're always being conditioned. So you give me inputs and I'll accommodate that. I'm gonna rise to what you're giving me, and I can assimilate to these various environments and things like that, right? So we're very accommodating, adaptive. So if we're getting high stimulus, data overload, and I'm a 16-year-old brain, my bar, my baseline is moving. To, hey, I can't self-soothe. I'm bored with something that when we were younger, we found to be very entertaining. You know, I didn't have phones in growing up or anything like that. So yeah, they can't get there. It literally feels empty to them because they have conditioned their brain to see that as their norm, right? So how you literally do that is you would titrate back, you'd pull back, and your brain will readjust. Have a lot of faith in your brain. It can move. That's why we're so capable of incredible growth and change. I see it every day. I see people come in stuck in their ways, very convicted, and I absolutely see an evolution before my eyes that still surprises me and keeps me in awe, quite frankly. So, but yeah, to your note, we are being inundated, and these teenagers are in a really different place than I was growing up and that you were growing up. And it does still feel new. It just does. I still think we're figuring stuff out. And then now we have the AI element, which is very, very, very new. So add a layer to that. And then what happens in just a few years, right? So yeah, they're in a tough spot. I'd say the one sort of common denominator I see as an output of a lot of the things we're talking about is prevailing anxiety. Anxiety has become like a really buzzy word. Some of it is people being anxious. I don't want to diminish that. But I will say when we were younger, that was just being nervous for something. You just got nervous to talk to a girl or to talk to a boy or to, you know, go to school. And you did think like, am I dressed well enough? Or you were afraid of getting made fun of or some of these things. So some of that is just the human experience and the parts that kind of suck. So, you know, I do think sometimes we get a little off the tracks with the whole anxiety conversation. You know, you are supposed to be nervous when you're on a first date. That's okay. You are supposed to be nervous when you give a speech at school or you go to take a test, right? So, but yeah, still with those disclaimers, I'd say the most common denominator I see as an output of that is anxiety. And then the other thing would probably be identity conflict, right? If I'm 16 and I'm seeing all of this stuff, I wasn't really left to my own sort of devices organically to kind of figure out what my hobbies and interests are, or at least in a more contained or more calm environment with not so many options and things and the comparative piece, right? If I'm 16 and I'm seeing all of this information all the time, I might run into a little bit of an identity crisis. So those are a couple of things that I see pretty often.
No, that's really interesting. So when I was younger, products didn't have much choice. I absolutely loved reading. I get a book out from the library at school every day. I think I was the first person in school ever to read every book in the library. It wasn't a very big school, admittedly, but I could pick a book of a fiction book and I could go to the plains of America, the depths of the ocean, the furthest reaches of space. I could literally go anywhere. And I had to imagine it. I had the words on the page. I could imagine it in my head. I could vision it. I could almost taste it. Whereas now it feels that you almost don't have time to use your imagination because you're being presented with, well, this is what it is. This is what it looks like. It's what it feels like, tastes like. This is what you should feel. Sorry. It's what you should feel versus here's just some words. You'll interpret that differently in a way than Brianna will interpret it, but we're both reading the same words, whereas now you and I have both seen something and it's, okay, we're seeing it. One of the things that I find kind of odd is that you'll see people that have paid maybe thousands of dollars for a ticket to see Taylor Swift and they're watching it through their phone. Or it might be the announcement of a new Pope, or it might be the president's inauguration or whatever, but they're watching it through their phone rather than being, say being in the moment sounds very woo-woo, but you know what I mean? We almost need this filter between us and what's actually happening. Why?
I think a couple of things come to mind when you ask that. One, back to sort of, we really like what's familiar. The brain doesn't care about you being happy. It's really not interested in that. It's not interested in you advancing in your career or even having a healthy relationship. It's really not. It doesn't care that the communication is broken right now. And it's like, okay, let's make that communication better. Let's do that discomfort. Let's get into the discomfort and do the hard work. The brain is really loves, above all, complacency and comfort and the familiar. So if we're used to looking at a screen and we're used to interacting with the world around us in this way, and this is our safety blanket and our comfort zone, we're going to be compelled probably to stick with that. So that's one thing that definitely comes to mind. But yeah, this conversation around what it means to be present is a layered one. And that's something that's getting a lot of attention lately. And I work with a lot of people, or I have a lot of conversations with people who are actively trying to be, quote, more present. And, you know, what does that look like for them? And for everyone, it's a little bit different. And we all have various constraints. But, you know, I loved what you said about the books and how you described it. It was so eloquent, so beautifully articulated. It was reminding me of my own story with that, because I'm in the same boat. And so, yeah, I'd read something and that was how I was transported. That's how I went into a different world. And there's a creativity that's happening through that because, as you mentioned, you could read the same book, but the world that you envision, the colors of the flowers, the this, the that, is different than what I see. So there's this exercising that's happening of your creativity and your imagination. And again, your ability to only have this, but to create this, but now we can just create this, you know, we can just skip right to that. And it's sort of served to us without that work in between. And, you know, I don't know if that's great for us as far as making our brain sharper, our acuity, you know, all of that, that creativity piece. So, it's a messy time in that regard. And I think, you know, they've got a leg up on us, the younger generations, because they have access to things we never did. If I didn't know the answer, well, I didn't learn that because I didn't know the answer. And now you can find it out. But at the same time, you know, we see on our end, you know, some of the benefits that we had from having a little bit more of a calm space that wasn't as inundated with some of that stuff.
See, it feels kind of ironic, to quote Alanis Morissette. You, at the moment, you're in Dallas, I'm in London. We're talking very easily. We're connected. I can talk to somebody in Australia later on. We can talk to whoever, anyone in the world. So we have the ability to connect with pretty much anyone, anywhere, at any time, really. But at the same time, all the research that I read and the anecdotal information that I see suggests that we are lonelier than ever before, that perhaps we have less. I think there's something in the UK, 30% of men don't have a best friend, or 45% of men couldn't name five people to go out for a beer with or whatever. So it almost feels that, crazily, even though we can connect incredibly well with anybody, anywhere, in theory, through the screen at least, almost our real life relationships almost seem to suffer. So I'm not sure whether it's you can have one, but you can't have both. I'm really interested in your thoughts.
You're right. We're lonelier than ever. And I hear what you're saying about, you know, the irony in that, because we're more connected than ever. But connected, you know, is not a universal term that translates into the same thing. So connected via, you know, Zoom or video platform or something is so radically different than sharing a meal together, or you're growing up and you're going out and, you know, running around with the boy next door, and you're forming a friendship that now, you know, maybe is a part of your life for the next 15 years. You know, that was quite realistic then. So this connectivity is not a replacement for experiential connectivity, which is where we're live. Mm-hmm. We're living life together and experiencing something in the full circle present, right? It is very different. I talk a lot about the eight forms of emotional intimacy, and I talk a lot about it in regards to couples that are trying to improve their relationship, you know, reinvigorate their connection. Perhaps their connection has waned and they want to get that back, or they're a new couple starting out and they want to get things, you know, right. But it actually applies to, you know, other types of relationships as well. So, you know, experiencing things together, talking about future goals, having existential conversations, you know, all that kind of stuff, right? And if we're doing those things live with someone, you are going to form deep connections. Today, if we're connecting via text or something like that, it's not going to serve you in that same way. It sort of is an outlier to those eight forms of intimacy that I often talk about. So, yeah, we are getting lonelier, and it is quite sad, and I hate to see it. And I ask people all the time when we're working together, you know, what does your network look like in a few different ways? You know, you're romantic. You know, do you have a partner? What's that look like? And then I always ask platonically, what does that look like, right? Mm-hmm. Do you have friends? Mm-hmm. And what kind of relationships is it with these friends? You know, and I'll dig a little bit deeper. Are they just acquaintances? Are they, you know, friends at work where, you know, if you left that job or something happened, you know, maybe you talked for a couple months after that, but the relationship would probably die. Mm-hmm. You know, what are these relationships in your life, you know, like? And then the third thing I'll ask often is, you know, who really sees you? Who actually sees you? Who knows? Who really knows? Because even those work people, it's limited. Even sometimes the buddy I grab a beer with, it's limited. I feel like I can't actually tell him what's going on in my marriage. You know, I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to kill the mood or the vibe. We're trying to be jovial, you know, whatever. even with my wife, maybe it's limited there. Maybe I want to talk about my wife or my marriage. That's okay. But so that's not necessarily the best outlet is her. You know, maybe you're struggling with something or you're embarrassed about something. So often when I ask someone, you know, who really sees you with all of that context, majority of the time, the answer is no one.
I can completely empathize with that. So what do you say to somebody then? So I come to you and you ask me that question, I sort of say, well, sure. Yeah, some work colleagues know this about me, my wife knows that about me, kids know this about me, but nobody knows me. Should somebody know me? How do I get to that place? What do I do?
Oh, that's a beautiful question. Should somebody know me? I don't know if I've ever been asked that before. And my answer to that would be yes. But you know, if we're, you know, working together or wherever you are, if you're going to therapy, that's a wonderful place to start. I know that it's a transactional relationship. I know that. I know that you're paying someone to go, you know, and speak with them, and they've got, you know, some education and all these things. I know that, but it's still an incredible place to start. Mm. Sure, a hell of a lot better than nothing or not doing it right. So I'll often invite people to, you know, let me then see you, you know, for the embarrassing parts and the truth and the raw honesty and your challenges and your struggle. And I think that goes a really long way. Mm-hmm. Think again, also with the brain and sort of, you know, things atrophying in it if we don't use them, like our creativity or our imagination or whatever. You know, same with that type of exercise, right? I'm telling you the truth. I'm being honest. I'm being authentic, and getting some exercises of doing that in a therapy setting is a great way to build some esteem, some confidence, and sort of retrain yourself to start to show up that way authentically in your real world, right? So therapy is a fantastic place to start for somebody who's going like, no one does really see me. The other thing I would do is validate it. And I don't mean this in a condescending way, as juvenile almost as it sounds, but you know, I would have to acknowledge to someone that sucks. That sucks. And I could imagine that you feel really lonely a lot of the time. And I also wonder, you know, what would that be like to just be who you are, or to have someone or a relationship or somebody absolutely see you and then choose to stay?
Gosh. it's fascinating. Because I mean, as I said at the beginning, I've got a 16-year-old, 18-year-old. My daughter's just gone off to college, just going to have to study philosophy. My son's 16, so he'll be going in a couple of years. And then my wife and I have been together for, well, married for over 20 years now. But I do sometimes think, we'll look at each other and I think, oh gosh, you're here. Gosh, you're here. Where's everybody else? And then suddenly, what do you call it? The sort of empty nester? Is that what you call it? You sort of look around and think, oh. And I sometimes wonder, and I'm not trying to get free therapy here, but I sometimes wonder.
You can, that's fine.
how do I or we almost create that safe space for a conversation? Not a conversation sort of, should we stay together or should we break up? That's not a conversation, but things are different now. Our children have left home. We can perhaps work less, we can travel more. What are the things that you want to do, I want to do? Because over the course of, it could be 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, things change. Things I like to do back when I was sort of 18 are different now. You know, we're at the age where perhaps menopause is a question, erectile dysfunction is a question, all those things come up, and you sort of you think we've never actually sat down, say we, a couple, has never actually sat down and had a meaningful conversation really beyond the day-to-day, gosh, got to get the kids to school, got to pack the lunches, all that sort of stuff. I wondered how you would almost guide somebody to have that, or to hold space for that conversation. Does that make sense, or does that just sound like nonsense?
Yeah, I think you're asking about couples who have maybe drifted apart very unintentionally, mm-hmm. due to just life happening. And then there's all this extra stuff that happens. You know, we don't just stay, it's not, you know, linear. Mm-hmm. We age, bodies change, hormones change. You've got the kids are a center of the world, but then they're gone. So literally your environment on a day-to-day basis is totally different, very disrupted. So I think you were asking about, with life looking like that, and you're starting as a couple 20 years prior, how in the world are we supposed to stay together in a thriving and flourishing and connected kind of way when all this extra stuff is changing?
Exactly.
That's right. Is that what you... Okay.
you're a therapist. That's exactly right. You've nailed it. So is it about... That sounds so simple, really. Is it about talking, communicating?
Yeah, and I hate to say that because I know everyone's looking for, you know, what pill can I take? Yeah. Yeah, totally. I'm right there with them, right? I'm all about the shortcuts where we can find them. This is not one of them, though. And I really hate to be the bearer of that bad news. It's just not. So communication is the absolute best thing, right? And it's something that we have to exercise. It will become easier the more that we do it. Communication begets more communication. It builds on each other. Yeah. So if you've lost connection or you guys have become distant, we have to start reaching for each other and sort of rebuilding that. The good news is that all of it is rebuildable. I really do believe that. I absolutely think that if two people set their minds to it, they can turn the ship around. Absolutely. I kind of think everything is, quote, fixable or solvable. But yeah, starting with yourself first and making sure that you are emotionally regulated. Mm-hmm. Emotional regulation, another popular term lately, right? Mm-hmm. It is not the absence of emotions. It's nothing like that. It's just simply if I, you know, receive an input of something that's scary or makes me feel a certain kind of way, can I hold space for that that doesn't threaten the other individual? Can I stay grounded with these inputs? And then also on my end, can I deliver to them things that feel challenging or scary for me, right? It's this embracing vulnerability. You don't have to feel comfortable. I didn't say that. Regulated, but not comfortable. That's okay. If you don't enjoy it, you don't like it at all, right? You wish you weren't doing it. That's totally fine. Mm-hmm. But start with yourself first, getting yourself regulated and figure out what if this relationship looked ideal. If it looked ideal, what would that be? And how is that different than I see things today? So first you mapping out some of these things so you can come prepared to conversation. I don't mean prepared like here's my slideshow. I mean, prepared like you even have a footing on, you know, what you want and how you feel about things. And also by doing so would help you be more regulated when those conversations came. And if you weren't in a place to have more of that deeper sort of what's not going great, what can we improve on conversation, that's totally okay. Start with the other stuff. Just go on a date night, right? Or reconnect. You can reminisce about the past. If that's sort of your easy button to talk about when we were 20, that's okay. If she's going through menopause, right? To check in with her about that. Don't treat it like it's, you know, the elephant in the room. You know, what's that like? You must be so tired. Mm-hmm. Since I don't know what that's like, tell me about it. I want to know, right? Imagine if someone said that to a woman that was in that situation. She might not respond great at first. Oh, it's nothing, or, you know, it's fine, or, you know, whatever, because she has to be retrained too, to know that, okay, he's actually being genuine. He wants to know, and this is a safe space here. And so she'll throw you that ball eventually and share with you. And that's how we start. We just start to rebuild like that. Mm. It's not out of reach though. I really swear, you know, that it isn't. And of course the 8 forms of intimacy, you know, looking into those and integrating those. A lot of those have to do with communication. Another thing I would say that's very concrete is, you know, there's cards. They're very popular, the cards that sort of are the conversation starter cards. It sounds cheesy. In actual application, it doesn't feel cheesy, believe it or not. And I'm such not a cheesy person, but they really do feel like, okay, this is making sense once you get into it. Because the cards are written so well, you're going like, okay, I don't think I would have come up with these questions on my own. Yeah. So yeah, that's another great place to start. So if you guys are disconnected and you do grab that date night, and we used to talk all about the kids and they're gone now and we're both kind of tired and We've been just sort of orbiting around each other, like break out some of those cards, and they will get the juices flowing. And you only need to do that for so long, or even just a couple, before next thing you know, you're having your own organic conversation.
Fabulous. Thank you very much. That is fabulous. And I think it's really interesting. I think one of the things you said then, all interesting, but one of the things you said then is about, it's really important to spend some time and think about what you want, what I want, what is it that I want? And I think somehow, I guess people are sort of programmed to think, gosh, thinking about myself, that's quite selfish, isn't it? But it's so frustrating to go into a conversation with somebody and say, it's like, so, well, let's go have dinner tonight. Where do you want to go? I don't mind. Where do you want to go? Oh my God, you just go backwards and forwards in this. Where do you want to go? Let's stay at home, forget it. And I think if you actually go to somebody and say, like, I really want to go and have a steak, Chinese, vegetarian tonight, would you like that? And yeah. Most people, often people say, yes, it's great that somebody has made the choice for me. So I do think it's almost the opposite of selfish to think about where you want yourself to be able to then come into the conversation with that. And we talked before about, we've had this amazing ability to be able to connect with other people anywhere in the world, but we are still relatively lonely. One of the other very live examples of that, I guess, is that within modern dating, you mentioned dating apps a second ago, we literally see somebody's picture and we can swipe left or right, and that's it. How does that almost enable or minimize our ability to form genuine intimate connections? Because that's not how we used to date. We used to meet somebody at work or in a bar or at a club or with a friend's sister or a friend's brother or whatever. Whereas now it's, okay. A few chats, then we meet them. Has that changed everything in terms of how we form those intimate connections?
I think it's changed a lot, significantly. But before that, I just can't without saying something about what you said earlier about, I would love for people to learn this. I have friends like this. I know exactly what you're talking about, where they think that they're helping by being passive and saying, I don't care where we go. I don't care. It's into you. They think they're helping. It's exhausting. They are making life so much harder on the other person. Yeah. Another thing I see is people that overly apologize. Oh, I was just trying to be kind, or I did my best, or you're putting it at, you think you're showing up in this way that's very kind and sweet, and you're the one that's, you know, saying no, but actually the other person has to tell you, oh, okay, you know, no, well, you know, you're fine. The other person is actually the responsible party. Mm-hmm. And same with the restaurant picking or, you know, whatever. So we all know people like that, that think that they're making our lives easier by saying, I don't care, or whatever you want to do. But yeah, I agree with you on that one. It actually puts more work and more responsibility and stress often on the other party. Now the exception to this would be like, let's say you're in a relationship and my guy likes to pick the places and he knows that I don't care. We already have that arrangement. We already have that information about each other. Yeah. So great. Then that dynamic works beautifully. But yeah, if you don't already have that arrangement and know that, you know, that's the case, then yeah, I hear what you're saying on that. On the dating app piece, yeah, you know, I love dating apps. I'm actually not against them. I know a lot of people are. I love them because, me being familiar with the loneliness epidemic, I recognize that it's got a lot of drawbacks and a lot of cons, but for a lot of people, it's their only option. And if they didn't have that and it did require them to go out to bars or what have you, sure, there'd be some good and that it would force that behavior. Mm-hmm. But for a lot of folks, it's just not that realistic. They are working, or maybe they're a mom, a divorced mom, and they're working and they have the kids at night and all these things. So to have something like that, to where you know that this person is single and seeking things versus rolling the dice and taking a chance, approaching someone across the bar, which I love doing that stuff. Of course, I support that the most. But yeah, these apps for a lot of people, they're what they've got. Mm. And without that, I think they'd be in a really tough spot. So I actually do really appreciate them. I think there's a long way to go and they are definitely due for an overhaul. But for now, I really can appreciate them. But there are some things that we need to think about and stay on top of if we're going to be using them, on how they're going to affect how we navigate potential matches, right? The swiping right and swiping left culture trains people for disposability, it makes it feel like options are infinite, right? Yeah. When we feel like options are infinite, our investment just plummets. Our investment decreases, right? If you've got, you know, 5 cars, you're gonna maybe, you know, get one kind of dirty and like you'll just take another. And this is a bad analogy, but I'm on the spot. I'm on the spot. And, you know, you clean the other one and you know, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And it's just gonna be different. If you have just one car and this is how you get to work, how you pick up your kids, how you require it on a day-to-day basis to just survive, you know, it's going to be probably a different relationship with it. You know, if you have the resources to fix it when something goes wrong. Mm-hmm. So when we have an infinite amount of options, well, when stuff gets uncomfortable or challenging or difficult, yeah, well, I'm out. Let me just go pick the next on the menu, right? I don't need to invest. I don't need to go through or towards the noise here. I can pull this escape hatch because I have somebody in my pocket that's ready for another conversation or a connection. So when our investment decreases like that due to this perception of infinite options, that is a grave, grave, grave consequence to forming deep connections. It means also that we're exiting things before giving them a fair chance. You know, maybe you go on a first date with someone and the way they chewed their food or something like that was enough for you to be like, no. So, right? If we felt like there weren't a lot of options out there, like back in the day when we didn't have the menu in our pocket, you might, you know, go on a second date. It could still bother you, but you're going like, okay, let me keep perspective here. So that's a big consequence, I would say. It also amplifies, of course, comparison, right? You know, we're thinking, is this bird in my hand, you know, better than the two in the bush? Should I go try to seek the ones in the bush? Because I know where that bush is at. I have it. So yeah, it amplifies comparison. And you wonder, is the grass greener? They did a study a long time ago that's very popular in colleges to be talked about. It's a study of choice, and they talk about these jams and jellies. A lot of people know that study and how, you know, they had at the grocery store, you come up, you try the jams, you try the jellies, and you know, here's your 20 options, and we have apple and we have cherry and we have all these and some more like, you know, wild flavors and all these things and whatever, and people rate the jams that they tried. And then they have them where, you know, they try just 3 or 4 jams, and then people rate the jams that they tried. And you know, when it's the smaller amount of choices, they're always rated higher. Right. So we can get the extrapolation to what we're talking about here. So yeah, that's an issue too.
It's almost like we with dating, we almost have a constant refresh button. We just refresh things. Where if it wasn't that long ago that literally you lived in a small town or small village, you could travel as far as your horse would take you. So your choice of partner was the 20 people around you. Whereas now you can scan through 20 people in sort of, in 25 seconds, really. And that's, that makes it hard, I think. And if you think about the business models of the companies that own these apps, they want you to stay on the app. You're paying $20 a month. So once you've found the love of your life, you leave the app, but therefore you're not paying $20 a month anymore. So for them, they're giving you somebody that's right enough or good enough, not maybe they're not maybe working it perfectly, so you do pick that perfect person, because then that stops them getting money, really. Do you see it? Obviously, our knowledge of Dallas, if you're of a certain age, it comes from the very famous television program, and we still see Dallas on television, and Dallas has an incredibly good reputation now as being very polished, people that are very ambitious. And I'm sure it's a mix, but that's the outside view, really. So do you find that people, how do I word this? People almost need to have a successful career, general life, to also have a successful and happy intimacy and sex life. Is it possible to have always one without the other? That's badly worded, but does that make sense?
I think you were asking, well, first, I think you were asking about Dallas and kind of what I see regionally. And I'm a big Dallas advocate, and for lots of cities. I try not to generalize, but yeah, Dallas is a tough spot to be. I mean, again, back to having really real and honest conversations. I mean, Dallas will eat you alive. It just will. It is a high pressure environment. Things matter here, like success, appearance, and status. And that's another thing that I hope people are talking about. If we're meeting together, and then add that with the dating apps, right? If those people on the apps are coming from that same pool, and they're struggling with the same things, can we keep up with the Joneses? How exhausting, right? So I do think that regionally, those things and pressures around success, appearance, and your status in these very performance cities where they're highly competitive, there's headquarters there of companies and things like that. I think it's an extra challenge to be there. Those don't necessarily reward or celebrate authenticity. And I'm making the pitch today and always that deep connections, intimacy, your identity, all of that is built around authenticity. So yes, it is an extra layer of challenge when it comes to being a part of these, more performative, heavy societal expectation cities. When our identity becomes curated, right? Intimacy is going to feel risky. If our identity is curated, we're going to get further and further away from our own authentic self. We go on that date from that dating app or go to connect with our partner or whatever, and it's going to be harder. So back to earlier, what I was talking about, where start with you, double down, triple down on you, refining that, getting that honed in, getting grounded there, finding your most authentic self and becoming comfortable with that person and starting to love that person again and not hate them or have, self-loathing around them. Dismantle some of that first. Because yeah, real connection is going to require showing, revealing the parts that don't fit the polished narrative. And that feels very counterintuitive. We literally tell ourselves, if I show you the unpolished parts, if I don't show you the curated part, you will not like me. You will not like me. And fair enough, I can understand that position because, right, they can go and swipe on someone else that does fit this image they're probably pursuing. But yeah, I believe that people can have it all. So I believe that you can have an authentic self, a successful career, a good sex life. You can have intimacy in other ways with a partner. I have to believe that people can have it all and that it's not one thing sort of sacrifices the other. And it's this constant game of, weights on a scale. I have to operate from that mindset. Otherwise, I could not help people. I have to have almost this, optimism around, you can have it all.
Do you have it all?
Just about.
That's good.
I do. I do. Yeah, I think, when I look at sort of my pie of life and the various categories, I'm really pleased with a lot of them. And there are a few that I am not pleased with and that I wish were different. And I feel lonely and I feel all the things that everybody feels. I'm part of this fabric of human existence, no doubt. But I'm chipping away at them and I'm devoted to that. And working with people is also healing myself. And so that's beautiful. But yeah, I think that I am, I'll say, I think I'm the closest I've ever been.
That's fabulous. And then I think the key thing is acknowledging and assessing the areas where you're not is key as well. So just two more really quick questions. One will be,
Yes, I've got 1 minute left.
You always have people that come to you and they come to you. They're not coming to you because their lives are wonderful. They're coming to you because they have some challenges and some issues and some things I'm sure at times sadly are quite dark. How do you nourish and protect your own mental and physical well-being? How do you look after yourself so you can show up as a person they want to be and show up for the other people in your life?
I'm actually asked that all the time, and I'm asked that a lot by clients. I was really surprised to find that. I guess I didn't think that anyone would be concerned about my side of the chair, but they are, which is really sweet, guys. But they will be like, how do you, listen all day to such darkness or, what people are going through and you're okay. I started in this environment at around age 15. And I've been in it to an extent ever since. So one, I'm not going to romanticize it, whatever. nope, I got a lot of years under my belt of dealing with my own stuff and hearing about others. So that helps a lot. The other thing would be that when I leave work and I shut, the office door, I do leave it there. We're not texting, we're not having conversations of a therapeutic nature outside of the session room. I have to end on time. We can't go over, those kinds of things within reason, because these are all the measures, sort of micro measures I have in place to where I could serve you at all to begin with. So I do keep that. And then I myself look at my own pie of life and my own slices and assess, where am I, deficient? Where am I not really getting things right? Where am I being complacent or pulling back? Or what am I, which is big for me, avoiding? So I also am evaluating myself. I don't drink all of my own medicine. I have clients also that'll say, I couldn't imagine dating you or being married to you. You must have the best relationship. It must be the healthiest thing. No. Yeah, I don't always drink my own medicine by any means. And when stuff is close to home, it's really hard to see objectively and the outside in. That's why I work with people that are CEOs in all shapes and sizes and that really have it together, but feel like these parts of their life they can't quite figure out. That's how it goes. It's how it goes. I myself have my challenges. So that's just how it goes. It really doesn't make you immune to all of these moments that we talk about.
Thank you so, so much for your time and what you shared. It was really, really valuable. So, yeah, I'd love to talk to you again. There's another million questions I could ask you. But thank you. I'll let you go and enjoy the rest of your day.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.